repeat some of the same things that we covered yesterday, but we'll have some different illustrations and add a couple of things that I left out. So if somebody that attended the workshop yesterday is listening to this tape, you'll be able to review some of the things that we covered yesterday. I hope that we'll just be able to whet your appetite enough that some of you will buy this book or borrow it, have it. It's DOS, it's a documentary, and it's a very inspirational book with a lot of details. It covers the entire life of Dawson Trotman. A lot has happened since his death, but Betty, the author of this book, as she checked with authors and publishers, said that people don't like for the hero to die in the middle of the book. So she closed it down with Dawson Trotman's death, and someday there'll be another volume that takes on after that. And then there's a book that has been mentioned from the platform a couple of times called Valiant in Fight. This is written by Laverne Tift, whose picture is on the front of it. He's expressed himself very well. He was aboard the USS Minneapolis in World War II, which was in 22 major engagements. Probably the fightingest ships in the war. But his story's not about the war. It's about the men who call themselves navigators in the 30s. And many people I know that have picked up this book said they couldn't put it down until they finished it all the way through. It's that interesting. One of my sons, who has to get up early, go to work, I gave it to him one night, and he sat up until he finished it before he went to bed that night. So these two will, I'm just trying to whet your appetite a little bit for what you could follow up in detail in these books. Actually, there's a third book been written. I don't have a copy of it here with me, called The Navigator, and it's written by Bob Foster. And what he explains in his book, the Betty's book gives what happened, and Bob goes behind the scenes why it happened, what kind of a person that he was. It's been said that an organization is the lengthened shadow of a man. And that's also true of a movement. The movement, the Navigators, is the lengthened shadow of a man, Dawson Trotman. I want to cover what I think is important. The reason there is a movement called the Navigators today, and about five steps in the origin. To do that, I want to quote from the man who succeeded Hudson Taylor as the director of the Old China Inland Mission. That's not very sharp, is it? How's that? Good. This is British prose, and you need to edit it a little bit down to get the meaning. But I know you can all read, but I'll read this so we can go at the same speed, or perhaps you get ahead of me. When God raises up a man for special service, he first works in that man the principles. Now, that's the word underlined, in your mind at least, which later on are through his labors and influence to be the means of widespread blessing to the church and to the world. So if we were going to summarize that in one sentence, I think it would go like this. When God gets ready to bless the church and the world through a principle or principles, he raises up a man and models those principles through his life. Does that make sense? That sound reasonable? So the Navigators originated in the mind of God because there were certain New Testament principles which needed to be revived or resurrected and made available to new Christians. So he picked out a man to do the modeling.
We have it just a moment. Oh, longer, Jim. Can we have it just a moment longer?
Yeah, okay. At age 21, this young man, Dawson Trotman, wrote a letter to the faculty of Dallas Theological Seminary. And two or three years ago, they discovered this letter in the files and sent us a copy of it. And I've got a part of it. I'm not trying to censor the letter. I wish I had the first part, but I discovered when I got here that I'd only picked up two of the three transparencies. So in the first part of his letter, Gunbaum, he gives his testimony, and as you can see here, he talks about overcoming a very rotten disposition. Then giving a little of his history, he said, I've been the president of one of the liveliest Christian Endeavor societies for a year, and have spent many precious moments in service for him. I've preached two sermons, and I've given many talks, and I'm not afraid to stand out anywhere and preach the gospel. My happiest moments are when I've spent in dealing with men, boys, and girls about Jesus Christ. As a fisherman, Matthew 4:19, I've won two souls to Christ. I say this only that you might know the little experience I've had. I love to pray, having had real burdens and delight in reading God's Word. I've memorized 10 chapters of the Bible and can quote about 120 passages. Being able to tell you where they are, I memorize while I work. Having set my goal for souls high, I must do big things for the Master. And I look to you as having had practical experience for advice as to preparation, realizing my utter inability to do anything but by and through Him. Expository preaching holds much attraction for me. Thank you kindly for your service. Well, I don't know what happened, but he didn't go to Dallas Theological Seminary. But this was the young man, a little profile of him, at 21 years of age. So I think the two things fit together. You know, God picked out a man first to model certain principles, and then that they would be passed on as a blessing to the church and to the world. The next significant event, I feel, in the Origin of the Navigators happened in 1931. Dawson Trotman had put together a little team by this time, mainly for witnessing publicly as a team. On the street corners, the band shell at Long Beach City Auditorium. And he found out there were certain things that he needed in his life by way of input that kept the output vital. He was had as a mentor a pastor by the name of Vernon Morgan, and he had put together an illustration of what the inputs were if we're going to have the proper output. And these were the Word, prayer, and witnessing. So in order to illustrate this, Dr. Morgan drew a three-legged milk stool. You may not know what that is, but I've sat on one many a time when I was a boy. And the way the legs are arranged on that, one here, and one there, that you have to sit on it solid. You know, it'll tip if you don't sit. It makes a good platform if you sit on it right. So he said these were the three important things in the Christian life, these three legs, prayer, witnessing, and the Word. Dawson Trotman looked at that and applied it, he said, there's something missing. He said, I've seen people that read the Bible, that pray, and that witness, but there's no joy in their life. Nothing to attract other people. Besides, he didn't like the idea of the Christian life being illustrated sitting on something. So he came up with his own illustration. And that fourth spoke, or the fourth element that was missing, he based on Colossians 3:23 in the King James, which says, whatsoever you do, do it heartily, as unto the Lord, and not unto men. You know, a joyous, victorious life. So he replaced the milk stool with a wheel, with which I hope everybody is familiar. This is what it looks like today. While the original version had this spoke, living the life, over here where the witnessing spoke is today. So he applied these things in his own life and tried to sell them to the people on his team. And he became more and more disciplined. And in one of the pages of his journal, he wrote that we reviewed the weekly requirements and decided we had too many. And then his journal said, so we added three more. So doing this, he was highly disciplined, but the people on his team didn't respond that enthusiastically. I quoted the last workshop, Dr. Bob Munger, who said, discipline without desire is drudgery. And I think that puts it together. So the other people didn't have the desire. They fell away. So Dawson took one of these fellows in 1931 named Walt Stanton, who seemed to be more alive than the rest, and he said, Walt, would you meet with me to pray about these guys? And Walt said, yes, I'd be glad to. So he said, I'll pick you up at 3:30 in the morning on my motorcycle. Walt said, thought he said 3:30 in the morning. And sure enough, he said 3:30 in the morning. So he picked him up at 3:30 in the morning. They drove to a little canyon that's located today right below the Torrance, California airport. There's an airstrip right up on top of the canyon there. And they prayed from 4 to 6. But the burden didn't leave, and they decided to meet again the next morning, and then the next, and the next. Now, I don't know, if the first 3 days, that was 6 hours. If you've got about six people to pray for, and by the time you've prayed for them 6 hours, you get run a little low on things to pray, don't you? In fact, you can cover everything you can think of probably in 1 hour, and then you repeat that the next hour, and then they've saturated these fellows pretty well. But the burden didn't lift. By the way, on Sundays they slept until 6 and then prayed until 5:30. Then they prayed from 6 to 10, 4 hours on Sunday, 2 hours every other day. But since the burden didn't lift, they said, well, now, we know some other people, like these team members we had. Maybe we ought to add the list to them. So they did. And before the 6 weeks was up, early in the 6 weeks, they had prayed everything they could think of for everybody they knew. So they said, I bet there's some people like this that we don't know about. You know, probably up in San Francisco or Seattle. So they began to pray for them. And then they spread out eastward and prayed for young men they did not know, and women, in all of the 48 states, which is what before Alaska and Hawaii became states. But after 4 weeks, the burden still didn't lift. So the last week, they took a map of the world and placed their fingers on various countries and cities, praying that God would raise up young men and women in those places like the kind they wanted those other team members to be. I asked Dawson once if he remembered exactly the cities and countries they prayed for. He said, well, I can name a few of them, but I can't name all of them. Today, the Navigators are active in 77 countries of the world. So we can probably reconstruct retroactive the places where they put their finger. The next significant event happened a couple years later after that prayer meeting, 1933. And those that have had some exposure to the Navigators have heard the name Lester Spencer. And the traditions grow better every year and with every story. So I have here about an 8-minute segment of an audio tape in which we asked Lester, now give us a straight scoop. What happened there at that time? So I have that on tape, and I'm going to play that 8 minutes at this point, and then explain why I think that was very significant.
See, this group of servicemen and this little gal teaching, I had some real good input from Helen. She had it all organized and it was great. And by that time I'd realized that I should back up and say that I was saved when I went into the service. I accepted the Lord when I was 11 years old in Laramie, Wyoming, but had never grown to speak of, because in those days we didn't have vacation Bible schools or Bible camps, Awanas, or those things. But my parents were very faithful in keeping up in Sunday school and in church. And I know there are days when my mother didn't have shoes that was fit to go to church in. But she saw to it that we had clothes and were properly dressed to go to Sunday school and church. So I was saved when I went into the service and began to realize that God had a purpose for my life. And so when it came time for me to be transferred to the fleet, I didn't request an assignment at all. And I just committed it to the Lord. I said, you send me where I belong. And you know the story that I was sent to the USS West Virginia up in San Pedro Harbor. And with that move, I was within 5 miles of Dawson Trotman. Very interesting how it all worked out geographically. And Helen and Dawson were in Biola together. And when I went to San Pedro, Helen wrote Dawson and said, look him up. Look me up, but I needed help. And that's right. And as you probably know also, it was Dawson's habit, before he went to work every morning, he would set aside a little time to go up in those Palo Verdes hills north of San Pedro and spend some time with the Lord. And he was very organized, had his little book, and my name was on one of those pages. I don't know whether it was now, soon, or later. But anyway, on that particular morning, my name was on the page that Doc was dealing with. So he said, I've got to look that fellow up. So quickly he closed up his book, got in his car, and headed toward Trona Field. Any of you know about Trona Field? Yeah. Installation there of the Navy and communications center. So Doc rushed down to Trona Field and sent a radiogram to me on the West Virginia. And the message read something like this. It said, meet me at the dock at 4 o'clock. I'll be wearing a light coat,
dark trousers, tan shoes, Dawson Trotman. Now, he had given the name of Rittenhouse originally for that message to be included in that message, but that hadn't gotten in there. So, about 8:30, I was cleaning up the dishes. I was mess cooking, hadn't been on the ship too long. And a fellow from topside, whose name was Spencer, I hadn't met him, came and handed me this message. He said, is your name, first name Lester? I said, yes. He said, well, then this must be for you. So I stopped long enough to read it, and I just sort of shook my head. As you know, there's all kind of con games to separate a serviceman from his money. And I thought, something's going on here like that. So I just folded it and put it in my little pocket there in the whites. But all day long, I was going to ignore it. All day long, the Lord didn't let me forget it, though. I said, okay. So how did he get my name? Where in the world did he have any contact with me? So that just kept bugging me. So I got someone to take care of the evening meal, and I said, well, I'll go over and see what this is all about. But I left all my money aboard except 25 cents for a water taxi home. I was there a little bit before 4, and after a while, amongst all those blue uniforms, I saw a civilian. And he was looking around. I thought, well, this must be the man. So I got up and went over to him, and I said, are you Trotman? Yes. You Spencer? Yes. And then he told me who he was and what it was all about. And then he said, how'd you like to go home with me tonight to a chicken dinner? And you know my response. And he said, I called Lila after I sent that message, and she's prepared chicken dinner for us. You remember that, Lila? So before long, we arrived at his home. A lovely time, lovely dinner. And then Doc said, let's go and have a little fellowship around the world. Fine. He had a Chevy two-door coupe. So we got in that car and wound our way up the hills there, and came to a place in the road that was wide enough for a car to pull out and park. And I learned later that this was Lover's Lane. That's why the policeman was a little suspicious. But we had settled in there, was reading the scripture Doss was reading. He had turned on the little light above, and I was on the passenger side. All of a sudden, there was a knock on the window right by me. And I looked up, and here was a policeman with a big star. And he knocked again, and I rolled down the window. He said, what are you guys doing here? And one of the things that I always admired in Don, he was always quick on the trigger. And he says, well, sir, we're reading the Bible. Is that all right? And you can see amazement written all over his face. There's a moment silence, and Doss picked it up just like that. He says, well, he says, if you don't believe us, he told us that he was the guard of the school. There's a big laurel hedge, about 20 feet high there. And he told us that he was a guard for that school. And Doss said, well, if you don't believe us, you just go ahead and unlock one of those schoolrooms, turn on the light, and we'll prove it to you. And so he said, okay. So he led us down into the schoolroom, turned on the light, and Doss began to deal with him. And the thing, I guess, that impressed me most about that whole thing was Doss's knowledge of the word and his skill in using it. This fella brought up all kinds of questions, and Doss didn't argue with him at all. And he had the ladder on his Bible, and he would flip that over, and many times right to the page. And he'd say, sir, would you read this, please? The fellow would read. And then he'd bring up something else. And this happened for about 20 minutes. And finally, the fellow had nothing more to say. And so Doss pressed him then for a decision. And he said, well, not now. I'm not ready. So we went on our way up the path, and I was so amazed. I'd never seen anybody handle a Bible like that before. And I said to him as we walked out, I said, "Doc, that was great." And I said, "You know, I'd give a right arm if I could do that." And he says, "Oh, no, you wouldn't." You see, he was baiting me. And he was really setting me up for something he had in mind. I'd already been prepared because of the experience on the ship. Fellas, you know, I want to take you ashore and get you into all kinds of troubles. And I wouldn't go. And this happened two or three times. And finally, this one fellow said, you don't go with us. You think you're too good for us?" And I said, "No, I don't think I'm too good for you, but I said, I'm a Christian and I don't do those things." And we were in the compartment there and several of the guys around. And he, you know, let out a yell. He says, "Hey, guys, come on over here. We've got a real live one." You know, and then it started. About six or seven of them. Word came Giddy's wife. And all of these things that I didn't know anything about. And I felt so bad because I just felt I was letting the Lord down. And I got out of those situations as quickly as I could. But it happened over and over again several times, you know. They were having fun. I thought they were. So I had been prepared on that side of it. And then Doss, as we walked on up the road, I said, "Well, Doss, I really mean that." "I don't think so." And that carried on until we got to the car. And then we just got seated there a little bit. And he said, "You know," he said, "you can do that too if you want, if you're willing to work and study, and you won't lose your right arm either." And I said, "Well, what do you have in mind?" And you know what he had in mind. So that began a discipleship that was great for me. And it had, the ripples are still going on. And that was part of God's original plan.
Say, just a minute, if you will, Lester, that this is so historic and so important that some of the rest of us have voluntarily given up part of our time to you. We want you to finish this. Now, this is official. This is... from Les, was there any mention of a bottle? You know, the part of the story says that the policeman said, "Okay, fellas, where's the bottle?" Is that myth?
I don't recall if he did.
All right, we'll correct the record on that one. Now, does anybody else have a question you want to ask Les?
The story has grown through the years, and part of it is, you know, as the policeman said, since this was the days of Prohibition, "Okay, guys, where's the bottle?" And the story said that Troutman said, "We don't have a bottle, we have a Bible." But that's not in Les's memory, so that's part of the improvement, the story that he doesn't recall.
But it does make a good story, Jim.
Yeah, it does make a good story. I think it helps it. I brought along a couple of videotapes that have been made, but there wasn't a projector available for this room. In 1985, 2 years later, we had Lester give this same story, and we videotaped it, and added one part that's very important. Shortly thereafter, Lester found another fellow named Gurney Harris, who had very much the same situation. He had come in the Navy as a Christian to save his money, to go to college and seminary and become a minister. But he had been in the Navy for almost 4 years, and his vision had dimmed somewhat. But Lester got hold of him as his first man, took him over and presented him to Dawson Troutman, and said, "Here's a man that needs what you've been giving me even worse than I do. And here he is, take him." Dawson Troutman responded, "You teach it." And Spencer said, oh, I could never do that. And Trautman said, if you can't do that, then I'm a failure. I'm going to start over with you again and get you to the point where you can teach it. So, Lester, we've got that live on videotape, if you want to see that entire videotape sometime. For 15 years, the navigators begin to live and demonstrate what grew out of these two lives. After World War II, as some of the people look back, you know, things kind of slacked off, and some of our fellows organized a think tank, and among the things they had talked about, why has God so marvelously blessed the navigators? And they said, we must have been doing something right. If we're doing something right, it must be in the Bible. So let's look in the Bible, see if we can find out what we've been doing right. So they run across 2 Timothy 2:2 and 3. The King James is one we used in those days. The things that you've heard from me among many witnesses, the same commit, the faithful man who shall be able to teach others also. And 15 years after this event, they said, I think this is it. This is what God has been blessing. That which originated that day when Dawson Trautman said, you teach him. And so Gurney Harris, the second man, left the Navy and spent his life in Africa as a missionary. Well, after Lester brought Gurney Harris and some other people over, pretty soon there was quite a few people who would come to weekends in the Trautman's home. Trautman was always very interested in individuals, and in order to establish further contact, he had everybody write down their name, their home address, and a military address on a clipboard. And after 2 or 3 years, he had quite a drawer full of these lists of people that had come over. And he was a very neat person, so he kept his desk clean. And he decided these weren't useful, so he started discarding them. Then he thought, I wonder how many states have been represented. He looked through those lists and found out that every one of the 48 states was represented on that list. And he made the statement once, I heard him make it, that men from every one of the 48 states had come to Christ in his living room. Now, it doesn't take too much smarts to put the two together, a prayer meeting and what happened. They prayed for men in every state in the United States. About 4 years later, men from every one of the 48 states had come into his living room. So he concluded, this is probably, you know, what God wants me to do, concentrate on these young men who are available. I may come back to something in this period, but I want to jump ahead. A period from 1935 to 1945 was, in my estimation, a very important period in Christian history. Between the time that William Carey became the first missionary and 1945, 150 years, the overseas evangelical missionary force had reached the sum of 18,000. In the 15 years between 1945 and 1960, it doubled. In the 30 years from 1960 to 1990, it increased to 150,000 overseas missionaries. Now, my research is not complete, but I'll tell you what I'm finding every place I look. I spend a week a month out at the U.S. Center for World Mission in Pasadena, where they do a lot of research. I met a mission executive one day, and he said, oh, navigators. He said, you know, it's very difficult to find a Christian leader in his field of knowledge whose life has not been vitally impacted by the navigators. Well, I thought that was an interesting comment. You know, he's an expert in the field. Then I remembered that when we had one of our first reunions, we asked our representative who had been in Honolulu for 9 years. He was a CPA by profession, kept good records. He also kept a record of everybody that visited his home. So I said, Harold, could you give us some of those old lists to see if we can get some names and addresses to invite to reunion? He said, yes, I was looking at them the other day. He says, there's quite a few of them. And I said, well, we'd like to have them. How many have you got? He said, 26,000. And very modestly, he said, now, some people might assign twice, you know, during that time. But during the 9 years, 26,000 people had gone through his home. The first year after World War II was over, Dawson Trotman visited several Bible schools that he knew. And he ran across 400 people who'd come out of the navigators that were in those schools that he visited. And by 1950, the people that come out of that ministry were in 40 different mission agencies. Between the years 1950 and 1990, the population of the world doubled. But during the same period of time, 1950 to 1990, the Christian population of the world increased 600%. The population 100%. The Christians increased six times as fast as the population. I believe that the catalyst of this movement that has produced 550 million Bible-believing, Bible-obeying, Great Commission Christians in the world today, the catalyst that sparked that movement was the disciple-making that went on between 1935 and 1945. Now, I don't want to say that's my final conclusion, but in my research, everything I touch keeps pointing toward that. So I want to tell you a little bit about Life Aboard Ship and this book that I held up. You know, it's got lots more information on it. But aboard the battleship West Virginia, and I mentioned this to the other group, a battleship in those days was about the nearest to a perfect laboratory that could have been created for evangelizing and disciple-making. When the battleship went out to sea, once you got outside of shore, there were no billboards, there were no newspapers, there was no radio, we had no satellites, we had no radar. And a lot of people brought a magazine the last time they were ashore. They were passed around, and every day another page disappeared from the front and back. So after a few days out at sea, all that was left was the middle page on that. If we were not in maneuvers, a typical day aboard ship, get up at 5:30, work till 7:30, have breakfast, and then the work day went till 3:30 in the afternoon. 3:30 to 5:30 was free. Everybody finished eating pretty quickly. In fact, the military, in evaluating how much space they need in dining facilities, found out that the average person completes his meal in 7 minutes. There's a vacancy every 7 minutes. So not a lot of time is spent there. So from dinner at 5:30 to 7:30 when the movie was shown, was again free time. Now, if we weren't in maneuvers, everybody that wasn't on watch went to movies at 7:30. So the Christian group had, we would spend from after the evening meal, 6 to 7:30, roaming a ship, looking for people to witness to. But once the movie started, then we had the next 2.5 hours to ourselves. So on Monday nights, we studied a chapter in the New Testament. Tuesday night, we had an evangelistic Bible study. And no Christian was welcome to attend that hadn't spent at least an hour and a half during the week trying to get somebody else to come. And we were pretty rugged in those days, and we'd ask everybody that didn't have somebody with them, you know, did you spend at least an hour and a half? And if they hadn't, they'd go off and get your life right with God. You know, you can't come to class. Wednesday night, we devoted to prayer. Thursday, we took a chapter in the Old Testament. Friday, we took a topical study. If we were at sea on weekends, we took with us books that used to be called the Moody Cole Portage Library. And we had all the sermons of Moody, Torrey, Billy Sunday, 10 or 12. We had every message these guys had ever preached written down. So we didn't have a conference speaker, so we would read one of these books. So we got to absorb all those messages for years and years. So that's what it was like. And we learned to believe God and to trust Him. If we were in port, many times people we knew would arrange meetings. So we had meetings all day Sunday, Saturday night, mostly young people's groups around. So one time when the battleship West Virginia was in the naval shipyard at Bremerton, we were supposed to leave that area on Monday, but all the work was completed on Saturday. And the captain said, we leave Saturday. Well, we had the full schedule of things arranged for Saturday and Sunday, that is, through Sunday noon. And we were devastated. Those young Christians here, we thought God set these meetings up. And we probably over-exaggerated the importance of our ministry in those days, but the idea that we couldn't carry through, that was devastating. So we prayed. Now, God, you got to keep this ship here. We can't leave Saturday. We can't leave till Monday. Well, everything was complete except one fire control circuit. And every time they checked it out, there was a short in it. So the captain said, well, you can go ashore till midnight. Everybody can go till midnight. And then we'll leave early the next morning. So we went over and completed our thing Saturday night. And all the way back on the ferry, we prayed that God would keep the ship in port. Well, Sunday morning, they couldn't find the short. So the captain said, well, we'll let everybody wants to go ashore go till 4 o'clock Sunday. So we went over, did our thing, came back at 4 o'clock. About the time we arrived, they checked out the circuit, found the short, and repaired it. But it was too late to leave, and so we left Monday as usual. I think that we felt that the U.S. Navy probably existed for our convenience. And we believed that God would do things, and those were very stimulating to our faith. Another incident that took place, not everything was this dramatic, but one of the fellows that we had aboard ship was a fellow by the name of John Prince. And he was a spirit and made some enemies. But at the end of 4 years, we thought he was able to go to a new ship. Actually, this is the way that we worked it. After 4 years, we felt a person was mature enough to go to another ship and start a ministry. So we decided the ship he should go was the battleship California. So in those days, the procedure was that when your enlistment came to an end, you could go to before the executive officer and request transfer to another ship
You'd stay another four if you put him on the ship you wanted. So I remember he went up to the request from the executive officer to go, and we expected it to be automatically granted, but he came down knocking on the door where my office was, and he was really downcast, and he said, I really blew it. I said, what do you mean? He said, I opened my mouth to say California, and Idaho came out. And the executive officer says, Idaho? Okay, approved, USS Idaho. No, this is the way it happened. So he thought he'd really blown it, but he was transferred to the USS Idaho. First day he arrived, he met a young man by the name of Alvin Abel, who had been a radioman aboard the West Virginia, and who had been greatly offended by his zeal in witnessing. And he told him, he said, if you open your mouth about Jesus Christ on this ship, I don't know what all the threats were, but he threatened him, you know, pretty badly. So as Prince told me about it, he said, I shudder to think what I prayed. But he said, I prayed, God, I pray that you'll either convert him or remove him. That's the first half of the story. The second half of the story is that there was a radioman aboard the Idaho by the name of Cecil Davidson. And this was about a year and a half before he became a Christian. A few years ago, he gave me a page out of his diary, 1938. He says, this was about a year before I became a Christian. He describes his activities of the day, and he said, I went on watch after the evening meal and copied the following message. And here it is. A.W. Abel, Seaman Second Class, died of unknown causes on the Long Beach Pike. His death certificate showed unknown causes. Prince prayed, I pray that you'll either convert him or remove him. And that night he died of unknown causes on the pike. Well, these things were very sobering. You know, they stimulated our faith. And we didn't worry about God being with us. The Navy existed for our convenience. There was an Air Force, a man in a seminar yesterday, he told me afterward, he said, you know, I was a Christian in the Air Force. And he said, I got a lot of free rides to go to conferences places. And he said, oftentimes, the crew never knew why they were being sent to this place. You know, why you, what's this trip all about? And they said, we don't know. So he felt that the Air Force kind of existed for his convenience as a Christian also. I think one of the things that you'll find as you read this book that probably is emphasized more than anything else is the word boldness, or the characteristic boldness. Warren Sanney often tells about the time that he came from his home in Central California to be with the Navigators full time. Came down on a train, and two sailors met him at the depot and took him out to the Navigator home on a streetcar. And when they met him, are you Lauren Sanney? Yeah. So one of these sailors looked him up and down and said, crooked teeth, broken nose, I think maybe you'll make it as a navigator. Well, the sailor that said that to him was named Curtis Carter. And I remember him telling me one night he was on watch as the officer of the ex-messenger, and he was standing with his head bowed and his eyes closed. The officer deck came over and shook him and said, what do you mean sleeping on watch? Don't you know you can be court-martialed for sleeping on watch? And Curtis said, I wasn't sleeping. The officer deck said, well, your eyes are closed. And you weren't sleeping? No, I was praying. And I said, you were praying? What were you praying about? He said, you. And the officer next said, What were you praying about me? I was praying that you would receive Jesus Christ as your Savior and become a Christian. Well, that was pretty characteristic of the boldness that existed in that day. Now, I want to say a little bit about Dawson Trotman. Personally, I worked very close with him for about 8 years. We got to know each other pretty well. Remember one day that we were lying at the edge of a swimming hole, the third person present was Elroy Robertson, who at that time was a world-class miler and became Fresno State and was the champion of California. He was going to the Olympics, but he injured himself in practice and never got to go to the Olympics. But as we were lying there by the pool, old Elroy, you know, his chest was so big and the muscles in his legs so big that even when he was asleep, well, they rippled. Dawson Trotman never weighed more than 120 pounds in his life, and he was mostly built from the waist up, very slim below. As we were lying there by the swimming pool, here was Trotman's coarse girl legs, and here was Elroy, these terrific muscles. And Dawson said, you know, I used to have a quarrel with God about my slight physique. But he said, then I settled it. I decided, well, if God ever accomplished anything through me, people would say it was because of his terrific physique. And so he said, I decided, you know, if he ever does anything new, he'll get the credit. So Elroy said, well, how do you think that makes me feel? And Dawson looked at him and he said, Elroy, as ugly as you are, you've got a greater disadvantage than I'll ever have. He always has the last word. I'll tell you about one other incident, and I'll try to wind down with this. Shortly after the Navigator secured Glen Eyrie, there was a fire, brush fire, grass fire, that almost, you know, threatened the buildings. It was a dry summer, but with the help of some volunteers and the fire department, they finally got put it out. And then, of course, Trotman, who was part of the firefighting crew, wanted to know how it happened. The former owner of Glen Eyrie had built a makeshift incinerator for burning papers. And what they did was just took concrete reinforcing rod, made square panels or rectangular panels, and wired expanded metal in between. So three of these panels were set up, and then the front one was a door, and then they put a top on it. So that was the place where you burn papers. Wind blows in Colorado most of the time. And this expanded metal was wired to the rod. But over the years, the wire had rusted and broken, and these panels sagged in every direction. There were big holes in every corner and the top. But apparently, after the Navigators moved there, somebody said, where do you burn papers? Someone said, well, there's an incinerator down there by the cow barn. Saw somebody burn some papers. And, of course, the wind took them up through the hole and went out, set the grass afire. Well, as Dawson gathered the crew around that makeshift incinerator, he had a pretty low tolerance for stupidity. And the idea that an intelligent human being would build a fire in that thing with holes in the side and roof was just more than he could absorb. So he gave it a lecture. And then that animated him to give a second lecture. And then he'd give a third lecture. I think the person that did it probably wasn't present, but the crew got the brunt of it. And they'd been working hard, tired, got a little sleepy, and he noticed he was losing their attention. And he said, you people think that I'm a perfectionist. And he said, you're right. I am. And furthermore, if I were not a perfectionist, there would not be a Navigator ministry today. That's interesting to me as his own evaluation. Now, what did he mean? Probably in this group, there's a few that have perfectionist tendencies. My wife has perfectionist tendencies, and I have to remind her occasionally that she's not in heaven, and she probably have to tolerate a few imperfections, you know, as long as she's in this life. But the perfectionists, you know, they're a little bit hard to live with sometimes, and they're kind of hard to live with themselves because there must be a perfect way to do this. And they'll think they have it when they go to bed at night and tell everybody, now this is it. But next morning, now there must be a better way. All the time looking for that perfect way. Nelson Trotman felt that when Christ gave the Great Commission, he was not giving an impossibility. If he commanded that this message be taken to the whole world, it was possible that it be taken to the whole world. And the reason it hadn't is because his formula had not been followed. As a perfectionist, he was going to find that formula. Now, I haven't got time to go into all the background here, but let me tell you about one incident I just learned about a couple years ago. There's a missionary executive by the name of Don Hamilton that you've probably seen his picture, name in the paper. He told me that he had been around Dawson Trotman in his home in South Pasadena, been involved in the ministry and the Bible studies about a year. One day they were out together and they met a friend of Don's, and the friend said, "Don, what are you doing now?" He said, "Well, I'm a navigator." And they went on their way, and pretty soon Dawson said, "Did I hear you say you were a navigator?" And Don said, "Yes, navigator." He said, "What makes you think you're a navigator?" And Don said, "Well, I'm in the Bible studies, I'm in the ministry, you know, I'm involved in all these things." And Dawson said, "You're no navigator." And Don said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Where are your grandchildren?" Not long ago, a staff member of the Navigators came to Lauren Sanney and told him about all the great fun and success he was having in evangelism. And after Lauren had listened to him a little bit, he said, "That's great. But," he said, "are you increasing the number of people who are doing evangelism?" And the staff member said, "No." He said, "I used to do that. But," he said, "too hard work, too much hard work." And he said, "beside, this is more fun." And Lauren said, "But that's not what you're paid for. You're supposed to be not only doing evangelism, but increasing the number of people." Well, let me conclude with this. Some of you that are from the Dallas area may know Ford Madison, businessman down in the area there. I know he travels to Moscow to meet with the businessmen four times a year, I think it is. He's involved every place. We had lunch together about three or four months ago. And I said, "Ford, what's your main ministry? You know, you're here, there, every place." He said, "I only have one ministry." I said, "Well, that's not what I hear and the feedback I get." He said, "I only have one." He said, "My wife and I figured out that we have about 18 years left, you know, of vitality. So we've asked God to give us one couple every year. And we'll spend an entire year with that couple. And at the end of the year, we're hoping that they will go out and repeat the process. So at the end of next year, you know, there'll be four couples instead of two. Four people doing this." And he insisted he didn't have any other ministry. Now, that was his ministry. All these other things, they're just diversions out there. Well, after Ford told me that,
I sat down in my notebook here and said, now, if this works out for the next 18 years, how many people will be laboring 18 years from now out of his main ministry? Now, if you sit down and figure it out, I think my mathematics is correct. How many do you think it would be? 100? 200? 260,800. If nobody breaks the link in the chain. Dawson Trotman, the perfectionist, discovered the New Testament formula for accomplishing, or at least the best approach to accomplishing the Great Commission. You know, I've never learned the difference between a workshop, a discussion group, and a seminar. I think there is a difference. You know, I think in a workshop, you know, that everybody's supposed to do something, but I didn't bring any handouts or anything to fill in or anything. But I think you should have an opportunity to ask a question or make a comment. Yes?
How did Dawson Trotman end up, his grave end up up there on Razorback Ridge? Tell
us a little bit about the funeral. Was there a procession that went up there, or was it just a few men that took it up there? How did that grave site end up up there? How was he buried? Yeah, well, after he died, people thought that'd be fitting, that he'd be buried up on the hill where he had claimed the promises for Glen Eyrie. And we checked with the local health department. And they said, yeah, there's no law against it, burying a body on private property. There is now, but there wasn't then. So there wasn't any trail, any way to get up the mountain. And there wasn't, of course, they had to dig a grave. So it was about 8 months, I think, before his body stayed in the funeral home. And while they were preparing the trail and the grave, so one day, Lauren and I were talking. I said, how are the guys coming on the trail in the grave up there? I said, well, I don't know. I'll find out. So I asked Dick Snell, who was a foreman. I said, how are you guys doing on that? He said, oh, we already buried the body up there. And I said, what? You know, he said, well, yeah, we, as soon as we got everything done, we just phoned the funeral home. They brought it out, and we put it on the back of a mule, took it up and buried it, and that was it. So that was the great ceremony that took place. And nobody knew it about it except the work crew, you know. That's not real glamorous, is it? But that's the way the body got up there.
Maybe you're a little bit off in Navigator history, but I'm curious, do you feel like there's any connection between the Navigator's presence in Colorado Springs and the great influx of Christian organizations that seems to descended on Colorado Springs?
Some of them came there because we were their number, Navigators in Colorado Springs were their number one customer, like Global Mapping and some of this. But I think that's a small part of the influence. As you listen to these different people, why they came, one, they came because other people were there that they worked closely with. A lot of these organizations all came from Southern California, and they were all associated together at the U.S. Center for Rural Mission. So, you know, they knew each other out there. They kind of moved as a block. But they will all tell you there's two things. The main motivation was affordable housing. You know, you can get a house in Colorado Springs for a fourth of what you can get the same house in California. And the other was the climate and lifestyle. So I think the existence of the Navigators there, you know, that's part of it, but there are many factors that came in. Now, you might be interested to know that the community is getting alarmed, and a group of people there have set up a watchdog committee to see what effect it's going to have on the city and the future of the city. And they get together once a month to evaluate what we're doing to their city.
Sacrifice chickens and things like that at the same time?
I'm sorry, I didn't...
Do they sacrifice chickens and things when they're doing
that also? Well, there's one story that I don't let get out very much, but one of our guys one day decided that he wanted to... we have a few rattlesnakes. We don't advertise that on Glenny Reef. And he wanted to give the crew an orientation on the rattlesnake. So he captured one and got a crowd around him. And he was pointing out where the poison was. And when he did, he loosened his grip a little bit. And the next thing, you know, it dipped him right in the finger. And his finger rotted off. You know, they rushed him to the hospital. It was pretty serious. But we tried not to let that story get out. You know, make us look like snake handlers. But I've shown people around and from the city, and they often say, now, are you sure you've shown us everything? Don't you have any dungeons or torture chambers or something around there? You must have something like that hidden away here someplace. Well, any other comment or question?
How long were you in the Navy before you ran into the navigators?
let's see. I went in the Navy in September 1932, and I went to the Trotman's home the first time in December 1933, so that was about 15 months.
Okay.
I did not become a Christian for a year and a half, but then I first met them.
Were you an officer then?
No, no, I was. I had 12 years enlisted, 12 commission service.
Wow,
that's
hard to get.
Was the Navigator military at all in the European theater?
After the war, it was discovered that people go to college on the GI Bill any place in the world. So we had two people went to France, go to university in Paris, and they took the Navigator Ministry to Europe,
but
opened it up.
During the war, were there any GIs or naval personnel?
Yes, they were wherever military personnel were. There was a Navigator Ministry, yeah, during the war. During the latter part of the war, I was in Washington, D.C., and we had a minister to people from Fort Meade that got shipped out. So they were in our services on Sunday, and they were on the battlefield the next Sunday. Right there.
Jim, what's the background on the contact with 1,000 ships and stations? On the brochure somewhere back along the line.
Yeah. I've got here, I didn't show it, an article in Time magazine, and Jack Holt challenged me on that yesterday, but it was written in Time, and he said, you know, he'd done some research, and there were not 1,000 ships and stations in the height of World War II. So I said, well, I think that figure probably came out that the headquarters had correspondence from over 1,000 different military addresses. Now, some of these people might have been in the same unit, you know, but at least that many different military addresses. Well, any other final comment or question? Bob Potter, I apologize to you for not having enough variation here.
Jim, just one. How would you summarize the impact of Dawson's life on you personally?
Well, John Crawford spoke this last hour, you know, in Isaiah 58, particularly the last two verses. One day I had the day off, and I was going to spend it with Dawson Trop, and he met me at the Navy landing. And just as soon as he picked me up, he pulled off in the first parking place. He said, I got to show you something. And he opened up the Bible to this Isaiah 58, 11, and 12 passage, and he said, now, this is something that God has impressed on me, that he's going to use me, you know, to build the old waste places and establish the foundation of many generations. He said, I'm scared to death. But he said, I know that God gave me this. You know, I know this is going to happen. And throughout our... my many years in staff on the Navigators, you know, oftentimes when we come together for a meeting, why, the Lord and Sandy would say, now, what promise has God given you? And I was always the odd man. I said, I don't have one. Because after he explained that to me, I said, that sounds good to me. I'll help you. So I've never had another vision other than, okay, that's what God's going to use you to do. I'll help you. So that's the impact it had on me. You know, that's what I've given my life to. Any other question or comment?
What was your contact with John Dedrick, Roy Robertson, and that crew?
Yeah. Okay, sorry. Wandering away from it here. But the first man Dawson contacted, Lester Spencer. The second man, Gurney Harris, he was a radioman. The third man was a radioman. He was a supervisor of Harris. So John Dedrick saw what was going on with Harris. He went over to see Dawson Trotman. Then the fourth guy that came along was Dr. Ed Goodrick, who just died a couple of months ago. He's the compiler of the NIV Exhaustive Concordance, which probably all of you use that have the NIV. He was the fourth one. Well, he and I had been in training together, so we knew each other real well. And every night when he'd been over Trotman's, he'd come back and share with me what had happened. So I followed him through everything that's happened to him. But these four, I knew all of them. They all worked on me. And it was John Dedrick who gave me the wheel illustration after I became a Christian.
Roy had come in Indonesia this summer with he was planning to go with MAF and was standing at the beach on his shoulders, Dedrick, and was going to jump off, except John didn't hurt loose his ankle. And so when Roy hit it, it shattered his elbow, so that took care of his flying career. And Dawson had told him, brother, says, that's not where you're going. And Roy says, what does Dawson know about where I'm going, you know? But then this happened within a matter of days and weeks after that. But John was part of that story, evidently.
Yeah. John's still alive. He gave his life with the Wycliffe, Yaqui tribe in Mexico. Okay, well, I think that's probably a good place to conclude. And Bob Potter, you're responsible for this. Why don't you lead us in a word of prayer as we conclude?